In our own information age, shaped by sometimes controversial wunderkinds like Gates, Jobs, and Zuckerberg, few may remember an earlier story of the contentious merger of technology and business that ushered in the American communication age. In his new book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communication Age, former Forbes correspondent and investigative reporter Scott Woolley reconstructs the overlooked story of one of the 20th century's greatest heists, the massive ripoff of the airwaves. Told through the lens of a 40-year friendship and eventual tragic misunderstanding between two men, it is a story that travels into the darkest corner of government and business. Again, the name of the book is The Network, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Scott Woolley to the roundtable this morning. Scott, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
What brought you to want to look at this battle?
Well, I had been working as a reporter and editor at Forbes magazine covering telecommunications. And, you know, so much of the modern world is really defined by these invisible connections now with our smartphones and GPS satellites that tell us where we are. And so I was really covering this from sort of a modern perspective. And I started hearing these early stories. And there was a couple books like Empire of the Air and A Man of High Fidelity that had told some of the stories of the early wireless industry, and especially the story about this one inventor, Edwin Armstrong, who had been wildly successful as an inventor. And then, and the way I open my book is in 1954, he's standing in his penthouse apartment considering killing himself because he blames his good friend David Sarnoff, who's the book's other main character, for kind of having taken covertly seized control of the airwaves. And so I was sort of fascinated by this story. It seemed half conspiracy theory, half sort of established fact. And so as I went to go, I started looking into it. I just got fell deeper and deeper into this mystery of what really happened between these two men.
As you mentioned, they are close. They were close friends. They were collaborators for decades. How did they meet and how did that bond form?
Well, they were both born, so they were both turned 10 in 1900 at the very beginning of the 20th century. And they, like a lot of 10-year-olds in 1900, were obsessed with this idea that you could send information through the air. There was really only the wireless telegraph. People weren't sending voices through the air yet. But they both kind of fell in love. And Sarnoff, at age 15, he's a Russian immigrant to New York. He gets a job with the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company, the first real wireless company in the world. And from there, he hooks up with Armstrong, who has made this great invention, the first real radio amplifier that kind of makes turns wireless from a toy into a powerful tool.
When they were together and working and things were happening, they were the force on radio and television. They were it, really.
Yeah, it was an amazing partnership through the beginning of the 20th century, starting with the wireless telegraph and the ability to send telegrams wirelessly across oceans. They then collaborated Armstrong's inventions and Sarnoff driving what became the Radio Corporation of America to create AM and FM radio. Armstrong invents FM radio in 1933, patents it. And that's where the real split began, because by that point, Sarnoff was really obsessed with television. And so the two friends, they were always great optimists about what the airwaves can do and were driven by this belief that no matter what amazing things wireless communication had made possible, more were just around the corner. And at that point, in the early 30s, Armstrong had turned his attention to sort of a better type of radio, and Sarnoff went off trying to pursue television, which would not really work as an industry until after World War II. But that's kind of the technical rift that started the real personal rift between these two old friends.
I want to get into that rift in just a moment. Before we do, though, two things to clarify. One is, at this time, at the time of the rift, Sarnoff, who is then the head of RCA, this is a very powerful entity. Give us a sense of just the power that this company wielded.
Sure. So after World War I, that when the American government for the first time really realized the importance of wireless, they didn't like the idea that the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company, a British-owned company, would control American wireless communications. And that was why the Radio Corporation of America was formed, to both put control back in American hands and to solve this patent problem that had grown up before the war, where a bunch of Armstrong owned probably the most important patent and a couple others, but a lot of other people owned different pieces of AM radio. And so the Radio Corporation of America was formed specifically as a patent pool where all the patents went in to this one company, and then the deal was that RCA had to license it out to other companies at kind of a single reasonable rate. But that gave them enormous power over the future of wireless as it grew.
So talk a little bit about what the government was trying to do, what they understood in dealing with RCA, because Armstrong would accuse Sarnoff of orchestrating the government to seize control of the FM airwaves.
That's right. And there, by the time their relationship was starting to fall apart a little bit before World War II, they both went off to play different roles in the war. And by the time they got back, FM had really established itself on the battlefield as everything Armstrong said it was. You know, a vastly superior technology. The sound was better. That helped General Patton in his tanks when the Nazis had AM radios, and so that was a critical advantage. It turned out to be cheaper because you could relay FM signals from town to town. You didn't have to pay AT&T millions of dollars to rent their phone lines like the AM radio networks did to distribute their shows. So by the end of the war, FM looks like it's a lock. And then all of a sudden, the government, and specifically the FCC, starts coming out with these crazy regulations based on theories that practically every major scientist say is nonsense. And so as a result of those regulations, FM's potential is really quashed. And by the early 50s, the number of FM stations is actually on the decline. And it's around this point that Armstrong becomes convinced that it has to be Sarnoff's fault. I mean, RCA is RCA. They own all the patent pool. They're this powerful corporation. If these bad things are happening, he figured, it must have been his old friend.
And what this basically turns out to be is a very unfortunate misunderstanding.
Well, that was really my conclusion after digging in and trying to actually find the proof that Armstrong had been searching for so long against Sarnoff. He held congressional hearings. He hired 17 lawyers to sue him, and yet he never found the smoking gun. And so the conclusion I ultimately came to is there was a lot of other people that Armstrong was not personally connected to, but had a lot more to gain from rigging the radio market. AT&T, as I mentioned, was making millions of dollars distributing AM signals. That would go away if FM was allowed to send signals wirelessly. So conveniently, the FCC passed a regulation to prevent FM radio monopolies, believe it or not, and what that and they prevented FM from lowering their costs by trading signals wirelessly. And the local stations also stood to gain, the local AM stations. But Armstrong, for some reason, never wanted to look at that other part of the radio industry and these other potential sources of corruption, and it had to do with just his personal connection to Sarnoff, and his that he was never able to overcome that sense of betrayal and really see clearly what was actually going on.
What was the government getting out of it?
Well, in a lot of ways, the government was just confused. I mean, wireless technology is still very complicated. In the 30s and 40s, people didn't really understand the airwaves. I don't think a lot of people still understand exactly how the radio spectrum works and how it's divided up and ruled and all that. And then 30s and 40s, the government was just sort of, it was new. You know, no one knew that all of a sudden there would be this, you could turn the air into a natural resource worth, at the time, hundreds of millions of dollars, soon to be billions and trillions of dollars. That idea just seemed crazy. So giving away the rights to the airwaves was partly done out of ignorance, and then at the FCC, part of it was clearly done out of corruption. They had the power to restrict competition and increase profits for different segments of the radio industry, and that's exactly what they ended up doing. At one point, one FCC commissioner was convicted of bribery, and there was a boatload of other evidence that others were on the take, the biggest just being the circumstantial evidence that the regulations they always came out with seemed to benefit the existing industry instead of the industries of the future.
Is there a parallel between what happened with the airwaves at this time around World War II and what happened in the 80s and 90s with the World Wide Web?
Absolutely. It's this, and this was Sarnoff's kind of guiding philosophy, and one that he shared with Armstrong for a long time, is that there would be these huge leaps forward in mankind's ability to tie ourselves together, essentially, with these invisible waves to increase our connections and to cut the costs of those connections. That scientists like Armstrong would continually be finding ways to unlock the power of these waves. So by the time the 1960s rolled around, and Sarnoff now is in his 70s and kind of at the very end of his career, he actually sees, and I was amazed to see this, but he sort of saw that next leap forward. He saw how microchips and laser pipes, as he called them, what we now call basically computers and fiber optic cables, would create a single global information network. And that the power of that technology would ultimately be so great that these communications cartels of the 20th century would be swept away. And for someone to have that vision in 1965, especially a 76-year-old, is simply astounding. I mean, nobody in 1965 believed him or gave him any credence, but it really showed Sarnoff's ability to predict the technological future by understanding how much power is left in the airwaves. And if we look at today, you know, 5G cell phones, there's the technology press is full of stories about how we're going to start using millimeter waves and all these other new wavelengths and new technologies that can once again lead to a radical increase in communications capacity. So what happened in the 30s and then what Sarnoff saw in the 60s and happening with the internet is basically again happening today. So it's interesting to see how these patterns of what patterns in wireless technology have repeated themselves now over more than a century.
When it comes to Sarnoff and this brilliance that you just outlined, was it overshadowed at all or complicated by the fact that Armstrong had made these accusations for so long and eventually took his own life?
I mean, I'm sure on a personal level, you know, Sarnoff would write these letters to his old friend, and even when he was being sued, he said, he was asked about his relationship, and he said, "We were good friends. I hope we still are." You know, at that point, Armstrong had been after him for over a decade, so it clearly hurt on a personal level. And as far as tarnishing his reputation, I think there was a little of that, but Armstrong kind of came off like a crank, at least in his own day, because he had all these huge accusations, and yet he never found a smoking gun, because largely because he was pursuing the wrong villain. So I'd say that the damage to Sarnoff was probably more personal than professional. You know, that's my take on it. But he never really suffered. He never suffered that much reputational harm until after both men died, and then a few of these books came out that basically made Armstrong's case.
The name of the book is The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves, and The Birth of the Communications Age. It is published by Echo. Scott Woolley, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks. It's been fun to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves. It's published by Echo. Scott Woolley is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.